The Catra Podcast conversations for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Catra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're tackling a source that honestly, it pushes us on one of the toughest moral questions out there, really demanding consistency from us all, the philosophical basis for animal rights.
Yeah, we're diving into the work of philosopher Mark Rowlands and specifically his book Animal Rights. And just to set the stage, this isn't about pulling heartstrings or, you know, cute animal videos. This is really about justice, logical consistency, and figuring out who belongs in our moral community.
Right. So our mission for you listening is to get a handle on the intellectual tools needed to really see the difference, philosophically speaking, between just wanting animals to be treated better, animal welfare, and the idea that they possess actual fundamental moral rights.
And Rowlands is such a fascinating guide for this. I mean, he's a serious academic philosopher, no doubt, but he also brings this incredibly unique perspective from famously spending a decade living with a wolf, Brennan. He wrote about it in The Philosopher and the Wolf.
That's such a crucial element, I think. It means his arguments aren't just spun out of thin air, you know. It's philosophy that's been tested against the reality of living alongside deep non-human intelligence and feeling.
Exactly. He blends ethics, cognitive science, even his own lived experience. It gives his work this, well, this distinctive weight, this grounding.
And that perspective really matters today, doesn't it? Because the core issue he tackles is something I think many of us feel, that kind of unease, that cognitive dissonance.
Mm-hmm, right. Why do we get outraged by, say, one person being cruel to a dog, but we participate in, or at least accept, these huge industrial systems that cause massive routine suffering to millions, billions of animals?
Okay, so let's unpack that. That dissonance points straight to the core question. Is it enough to just owe animals better treatment, a nicer cage, maybe? Or do they have inherent rights that mean we shouldn't be using them as resources at all?
Before we even get to the justice part, though, we have to nail down this first key distinction Rowlands makes. It's vital. The difference between welfare and rights.
Okay.
So animal welfare, generally speaking, comes from a utilitarian viewpoint. It's about improving conditions, minimizing pain, making suffering less severe. It basically accepts that we can use animals for food, for research, whatever, but we should try to be, well, nicer about it.
A more comfortable cage, as Rowlands puts it.
Exactly. Whereas animal rights thinking challenges the cage itself. It's deontological, focused on duty and justice. Mm-hmm. It asks, do humans even have the moral right to treat other sentient beings as property or tools, regardless of how humanely we do it?
Okay, that's a fundamental split. So if we're talking rights, what's the basis? How do we decide who gets these rights?
Well, Rowlands argues very forcefully that the only non-arbitrary dividing line is sentience. The capacity to feel pleasure, pain, to have experiences that matter to you as an individual.
But hold on, isn't sentience itself a bit fuzzy? I mean, where do you draw that line? A fish, an insect. Doesn't that feel a bit subjective to build fundamental rights on?
It can seem that way initially, yeah. But Rowlands uses a classic philosophical tool here, the argument from marginal cases, to really push for consistency.
Ah, right.
He points out that the usual reasons people give for excluding animals, things like complex reasoning, language, moral agency, well, if you apply those strictly, you'd also have to exclude certain humans.
You mean like infants? Or people with profound cognitive disabilities?
Precisely. We readily accept these humans as moral patients. They're on the receiving end of moral actions. They have protections, rights, even if they can't reason about morality or have duties themselves.
Okay, I see. So if we protect human moral patients who lack those specific capacities,
then logical consistency demands we extend that same protection to non-human sentient beings who also lack those capacities. To not do so, Rowlands argues, is simply arbitrary prejudice based on species membership. It's speciesism, plain and simple.
That framing definitely sounds like it echoes some of the arguments from the utilitarian camp, like Peter Singer's work on equal consideration of interests. That was huge in challenging speciesism, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely huge. Singer's work was revolutionary in getting people to take animal suffering seriously based on that utilitarian principle. But Rowlands sees a fundamental flaw if you're aiming for inviolable rights.
Because utilitarianism is ultimately about the total sum of happiness.
Exactly. It's about maximizing overall welfare, the greatest good for the greatest number. And the tricky thing is, what's fascinating here is that focus on the aggregate.
Meaning the individual can get sacrificed for the group benefit.
Potentially, yes. In principle, utilitarianism could justify causing significant harm to one individual even one animal, if it led to a greater overall benefit for many others. Think like a painful experiment on one to save 10.
Right. So utilitarianism might give us better treatment on average, maybe, but it can't guarantee fundamental protection for the individual against being used if the numbers stack up that way.
Precisely. It can't provide that robust foundation for rights that cannot be overridden by calculations of utility.
Okay, so we need something grounded in justice, something that shields the individual regardless of the overall calculus, which leads us to Rowland's really big move, applying contractarianism.
Yeah, this is where he builds on John Rawls' famous thought experiment, the original position and the veil of ignorance. You know, the idea that we should decide the principles of a just society from behind a veil, not knowing our own race, class, gender, talents.
So you design fair rules because you don't know if you'll end up advantaged or disadvantaged.
Exactly. Now, here's where Rowland makes this incredibly bold but logical extension. He asks, what if behind that veil of ignorance, you also didn't know your species?
Oh, wow. Okay.
You might be born human. Or you might be born, say, a pig crammed into a factory farm crate. Or a monkey in a research lab.
Right. And if you're a rational agent trying to protect your own interests from behind that veil, knowing you could end up in the most vulnerable position imaginable.
You would never agree to principles that allow sentient beings to be systematically treated as mere objects, as resources, as means to someone else's end. Because you might be that sentient being.
So impartial justice, derived from this extended original position, actually requires us to grant fundamental rights to all sentient beings.
That's the core of his argument. And it circles back to that distinction. Animals are moral patients. They deserve moral consideration and protection, even if they aren't moral agents who can understand contracts or have reciprocal duties.
It's like the human infant example again. We accept they have rights and deserve protection, even though they can't sign a contract or promise to uphold our rights in return.
Exactly. Rowlands argues that this lack of reciprocity isn't a valid reason to deny fundamental protections to any being capable of suffering and having experiences that matter to them, regardless of their species.
Okay, let's bring this down to earth then. What does this actually mean for how we live, how society is structured? Because right now, so much is based on what he calls instrumentalism, right? Using animals as tools.
Absolutely. And if you accept Rowland's rights-based framework, the implications are, well, they're massive. Take food and agriculture.
Yeah.
He argues that factory farming isn't just unfortunate or cruel. It's a profound moral injustice. It fundamentally violates the rights of sentient beings by treating them purely as resources.
So under this view, choosing a plant-based diet isn't just a personal preference or, you know, a health choice.
It becomes an ethical mandate. It's what justice demands. It shifts it completely out of the realm of lifestyle options and into fundamental ethics.
Wow. That's a genuinely radical conclusion for most people's daily lives. It really forces the question of whether we're willing to be that consistent.
And it applies just as rigorously to animal experimentation. The rights view is far, far more restrictive than the utilitarian one.
How so?
Because using an animal as a tool for research, subjecting it to potentially harmful procedures for our benefit, fundamentally violates its right not to be treated as a mere resource.
So the only justification would be, what?
It would only be permissible under circumstances where we would also find it permissible to use a non-consenting human moral patient for the exact same experiment.
Like the orphaned infant example again.
Precisely. Someone who lacks agency can't consent. And very few people would condone performing potentially harmful non-therapeutic experiments on an infant. So Rowlands uses that as a consistency check. If it's wrong for the human moral patient, it's wrong for the animal moral patient.
It really does expose the species bias when you frame it like that. Okay, but what about the really tough cases, like wild animals, predation? Does this mean we have a duty to, I don't know, stop lions from eating zebras?
Right, the problem of predation. Rowlands addresses this. He brings it back to the difference between negative and positive duty.
Okay, negative duty is?
Duty not to harm. Our primary duty towards animals arising from justice is the negative duty not to harm them, not to use them, not to violate their rights.
And positive duty.
That would be a duty to assist or intervene. Rowlands argues we generally do not have a positive duty to intervene in natural processes like predation.
Why not?
Well, first, the lion isn't a moral agent. It's not bound by moral rules. It's acting on instinct. Second, attempting to police the entire natural world to stop all predation would be practically impossible and ecologically catastrophic. It's beyond our capability and arguably our responsibility.
So The focus remains squarely on our actions, human responsibility, and ensuring justice within the sphere where we are the moral agents making choices. It's not about redesigning nature.
Exactly. It keeps the focus on human moral consistency.
Okay, let's try to pull the main threads together then. What are the core theoretical pillars he builds this on?
I'd say two really stand out. First, the deep critique of speciesism, highlighting the arbitrariness of species membership. He hammers home that using species alone as a reason to deny rights is just as illogical and unjust as using race or sex. It's discrimination based on a morally irrelevant factor.
Makes sense. And the second?
The continuity thesis. The idea that the differences we observe between humans and other animals in thinking, feeling, awareness are differences of degree, not fundamental kind. We're all on a spectrum of sentience and cognitive ability.
Which undermines any attempt to draw a sharp, absolute line at human and say moral worth stops there.
Precisely. It reinforces the idea that moral consideration should extend along that spectrum of sentience. You know, Roland's real achievement, I think, is taking animal rights out of the realm of maybe just pure emotion or sentimentality.
Right.
And showing that it's actually a deeply rational position. It's a logical extension of our existing moral principles, a continuation of how we've historically expanded our circle of moral concern to include groups previously left out.
That's a powerful way to frame it, which really leads us to the final thought, the provocation for everyone listening. Roland's work kind of flips the script, doesn't it? It shifts the burden of proof.
Completely. The question stops being, can we prove animals deserve rights?
And instead becomes,
can we provide any rational, consistent justification for continuing to exclude them from our framework of justice, given that they are sentient? Rawlins argues that, based on consistency and impartiality, we actually can't. The logic points firmly towards inclusion.
A challenging idea to sit with. Thank you for walking us through that complex but really crucial argument. It's certainly given me, and I hope you listening, a lot to think about regarding consistency and justice.
It's definitely work that stays with you. It forces you to examine assumptions you might not have even realized you had about who matters and why.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.